from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch will join us for a wide-ranging discussion all about his recent book on Bill Clinton and the Clinton presidency. Throughout President Clinton's 8 years in office, Taylor Branch had unprecedented access to the president and secretly recorded some 79 conversations at Bill Clinton's request. An hour on our 42nd president and some of his candid and private discussions, all about foreign policy and domestic policy, as well as his take on many of those with whom he came in contact. And we'll have your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch and President Bill Clinton were friends and briefly roommates working together back in 1972 in Texas for the McGovern presidential campaign. Over two decades later, President Clinton asked Taylor Branch to be his secret diarist. The two recorded some 79 conversations taped from 1993 through to 2001, and the result from notes recorded by Taylor Branch is the Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, a nearly 700-page book by the best-selling author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 63, and that was part of a trilogy, you may recall. Pillar of Fire was the second, and At Canaan's Edge the third, all about America in the King Years. And Taylor Branch joins us for this morning's opening forum hour in studio. Good to see you. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, we're joking around about the fact that the secret role that you had was sort of, you might as well have been an intern. I mean, you didn't really have access to the White House, and you were kind of coming in different doors. But let's go back to the genesis of this. I guess it was Catherine Graham Party. Bill Clinton sort of took you aside.
He did. His office called and asked me when he was president-elect if I would, said the president wanted to see me, and would my wife and would I like to come to Catherine Graham's party. And I said, fine. What does he want to see me about? We have no idea. So we went down there, and we were the only two somewhat awed civilians, as it were, because it was ambassadors and the Supreme Court justices and generals and Henry Kissinger and William Sapphire and all these people and Christie and me. And she was at Gore's table, and I was at Clinton's table. And before, when the president-elect came through, with people swirling to get at him, he made a beeline over to me, posted two Secret Service agents briefly to hold back the crowd, turned to me, and we hadn't seen each other in 20 years, and says, can you believe all this? Which instantly connected me with my old buddy, who I had thought had been processed into a different creature. And instead, it's still Bill. And he said, I've only got a second. I read the footnotes in Parting the Waters, and I want to know if my presidential library will have records vivid enough to allow historians to do what you are doing 50 years from now. And about that time, would you think about that? And about that time, the dam broke and people came all around him, and he left me kind of awestruck that he was thinking about the records and history, which he loves almost as much as politics, even before he took office. And he took advantage of the fact that somebody he knew had been working in presidential history. And that began the negotiations out of which the diary project began, because I told him that I am very concerned about records where presidents are not recording their phone conversations. Since Nixon. But every president between FDR and Nixon did do some recordings, and they are now extinct and before they're even incorporated into most histories, and that we don't really have very good raw materials in order to be really appreciate our presidents as human beings running a people's government without these recordings. And he had a number of ideas about how we might compensate for that, including moving me in the White House as like an in-house historian, which I didn't think was a good idea, and I couldn't find anybody else to do. But this idea of doing a secret oral history is what we eventually lit on to as the next best thing that we could do. And
it's a fascinating story. I mean, particularly it seems from the beginning he wanted you to be sort of like our Arthur Schlesinger was for JFK, and these tapes wound up in his sock drawer, but then you made your own tapes of the sessions once you got this underway, this project underway, and that's this book that has so many, amazing and enlightening stories in it, and I want to talk with you about them. But first, he's a notorious talker. I mean, it certainly comes across in the book just how much he was almost borderline logorrheic in some ways. I mean, and all over the place with his garrulousness. I mean, he just went on and...
He is garrulous, but there's a pattern to it. He's a puzzle worker. His mind is always trying to solve puzzles, and he's bringing in experience from different places, from different parts of the world, from different parts of the government, from folk stories in Arkansas to bear on, you know, trade agreements in China.
And playing hearts and smoking a cigar that's unlit and doing crossword puzzles.
Now, that's kind of the multitasking part of him, which is notorious as well. But he's always carrying on a conversation, usually about something that he wants to do in government. And he's doing it in a kind of relentlessly cerebral way, trying to figure out what to do on, you know, health care or tax reform or Bosnia or Haiti or any number of problems that he was dealing with. He said that if he had a gift, he thought it was a gift to marry kind of this relentless, wonkish analysis with an ability to connect with people, make a connection with a person, that he could walk into a room and make connection with the people that make it happen. Because he said wonkish knowledge is inert if you can't connect it to the human beings that can bring it into reality. And in that sense, he loved making connections with political leaders in the United States, even with Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole when he was working with them, and foreign leaders. He said his greatest failure at one point in foreign policy was that he could not make a personal connection with President Jiang Zemin of China. And he said that injured the foreign policy of the United States because obviously of China's size and its impact in economic and environmental development. But that he couldn't break through with, you know, humor or something about his family, that Jiang Zemin remained opaque. And essentially saying the United States is a passing fancy. He told the president that your prisons are full, your cities are uninhabitable, and your schools don't work. Who's to say your freedom is worth it?
And who's to say that you should tell us about human rights, in effect, context.
That's right.
But there's also the connection he made with Boris Yeltsin. And one of the more, I suppose, sensational stories here is Boris Yeltsin in his pajamas, drunk as a skunk, as we used to say, trying to hail a cab to go and get a pizza. I mean, these kind of stories are really embedded in this whole history about just how irrational some of these people are. And speaking of irrationality, I mean, Clinton had also the reputation for being, and he was pretty notorious for his temper, and that comes across as well. I mean, you experienced some of that.
Some of it directed at me.
Yeah.
More of it directed at the New York Times, which was quite, or the press in general and the New York Times in specific. By the end, I decided that there was a reason for that. You know, he and I had in common Southerners, white Southerners who grew up in the Civil Rights era, and we both idolized the New York Times because the journalism of the Civil Rights era was a heyday in American journalism, contributing to democratic revolution. Claude Sitton and John Herbers and the reporters for the New York Times who risked their lives back then. And by contrast, he was very disappointed that he thought the New York Times was keeping up tabloid fantasies about Whitewater and Vince Foster and China Gate and imprisoning Wen Ho Lee and saying that he had given away nuclear secrets to the Chinese for campaign contributions. He thought that hurt the country. But more than that, he was disillusioned because we had looked up to the New York Times so much during its golden age. So there were a lot of tirades about the press. But even there, President Clinton can't be mad very long before he starts trying to figure out where this is coming from and theorizing and trying to puzzle work on the media. And he had endless theories about that. He even said that he felt that a lot of it, as early as 1994, was because their markets were atomizing and breaking up, and that they felt they couldn't compete unless they were offering tabloid takes rather than more statesmanlike takes on what really mattered. So we said they're going to ignore our progress to eliminate the deficit, which nobody thought was possible, and what that will mean to future generations in order to entertain people about Filegate and Travelgate and various other aspects of Kenneth Starr's goose hunt.
He said about the notorious Monica Lewinsky episodes, "I just cracked." I mean, as opposed to, you know, because I could and is and all these other kinds of things. Very candid about the fact that the sort of pressure he felt was really the catalyst behind his going off with Monica Lewinsky.
Yes, and he connected it to self-pity. He cracked in self-pity.
He comes across a very self-pitying guy, actually, yeah. And he was. Right?
He said that was his chief character fault, that he had combated all of his life, without necessarily connecting it to his youth. You know, being the stepchild of a battering alcoholic father, and not really knowing that his father was not his real father until he was a teenager. He didn't connect it to that, though. He just said that self-pity was his big problem, and that self-pity came to him in several waves when he felt sorry for himself because he thought he was doing a good job, but that the whole country and the political culture was consumed by extraneous matters and gave him no credit for it. And in those periods when he felt sorry for himself, he cracked. And Monica Lewinsky, I didn't really realize, of course, because I didn't know, he didn't talk about it before the scandal broke. But the affair was kind of a crazy thing in two fitful episodes. One, when the government was about to be shut down, and he felt that was he was feeling sorry for himself then because he thought he was doing a good job and the reward was the government shutting down. Then he broke it off for a year. And the second one was after his reelection in 1996 when he thought that reelection was going to give him a respite from all of the tabloid nonsense. And instead, it only spiked up to another level because in addition to all of the Whitewater things, the Times started this thing about contributions and that the Chinese had bought the election and that Al Gore was in the Buddhist temple and that Clinton was selling the Lincoln bedroom and all of that. And he said that's when he felt sorry for himself all over again and briefly renewed his acquaintance with Monica Lewinsky.
Felt sorry for himself later on when he started to, and we're getting ahead of the toward the end, but started getting all that heat about Mark Rich and the pardon. It seems, again, there was a lot of self-pity. And he said, at one point, I believe you point out, well, what about Bush Sr. and Cap Weinberger? I mean, all the time kind of wanting to exonerate himself by analogies like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he said right at the end, he said, I got spanked coming in the door in 93 and spanked going out the door in 2001 in the sense that he said the political culture wouldn't really talk about things that were serious. You know, coming in was gays in the military, which he points out you will never see anybody acknowledge the fact that gays in the military was not his initiative, the first thing that he wanted to do. It was the front page headline in the New York Times on the morning after the inauguration with pictures of him giving the inaugural address, and the column one headline was Clinton to emphasize gays and lesbians in the military. And he said that was clearly a fiat, a press coup that a reporter went to one of his gullible aides and said, does the president mean all of his 421 campaign pledges? Yes, of course. Does that include incorporating gays and lesbians into the military? Yes. Therefore, headline, they're going to emphasize that. And I said, well, you didn't have the power then to retract that and say, listen, this is obvious. If you looked at all of the transition town four on the economy and that you had run on the economy and you were planning to have the stimulus package and your Budget Reconciliation Act be your first priorities before health care, we're going to do that and get to gays in the military in time. He said that would have been impossible. Then the headline would have been that I was repudiated what I had said yesterday. So he acknowledged that from the very beginning, the agenda was diverted into the most sensational and entertaining things, and that the same thing happened at the end of his presidency when instead of talking about his farewell recommendations on the deficit and peacekeeping. All of the press was about Mark Rich and whether or not his people had vandalized the computers at the White House.
And what they may have taken with them in the way of stealing. And
yes.
Taylor Branch with us this hour, the author of The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. He'll be speaking tonight at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7:30 p.m. And we learned from your book, I remember Bill Clinton once said during his administration that the most serious hotspot in the world, more so even than the Middle East, Israel and Palestine, was Pakistan and India. And we learned, for example, that both sides during his administration were talking about using hundreds of killing hundreds of millions with nuclear war, or with what they almost saw as inevitably nuclear war, but also he describes as his most ferocious encounter in politics, barring none, the argument he had with the Prime Minister of Pakistan to withdraw troops from Kashmir. I mean, both of those things, I think, kind of connect for me with that statement he once made of this is the most serious and most volatile place in the world.
Yes, and I didn't know any of this, and so gathering this in the secret tapes was kind of chilling. And I didn't even know he had had these meetings with Prime Minister Sharif. Basically, he said that Sharif said that his own military had sneaked fighters into Kashmir to ambush the Indians, the Indian government, Indian soldiers in Kashmir, in collaboration with Al-Qaeda, with Osama bin Laden. So that the military in Pakistan was working with Osama bin Laden to try to stimulate a military exchange that could lead to nuclear war over Kashmir between Pakistan and India. And he was trying to get – Sharif was feeling that his whole government, the elected prime minister, may fall apart, and announced that he was coming to Washington to try to get Bill Clinton to undo it. And Clinton said, don't come. And he came anyway. And he said they went over to Blair House and had just a ferocious argument in which Sharif said, if I withdraw these troops from Kashmir without some excuse, they're going to overthrow me and they're going to kill me.
Musharraf.
Musharraf will kill me. And Clinton said, you have to do that, and I cannot intervene in this. India doesn't want me to. They are clearly in the right here. We've got to reduce tensions between you people. And Sharif said, I can't do it. Musharraf is now a hero in my country because we've started this war in Kashmir. And if I withdraw the troops, I'll get overthrown. And sure enough, the president persuaded him to go back and withdraw the troops from Kashmir, and he was overthrown by Musharraf. And then the president said he spent the next year trying to keep Musharraf from killing Sharif. He said he wants to kill him because he resents the fact that Sharif withdrew him from Kashmir. And later he went over there to try to reduce tensions, and it's the only time he ever told me that he was actually fearful for what was going to happen, because he said there were
Bin Laden made that, threats
that
on his
Bin
life.
Laden had plots to shoot him down with a shoulder fired missile, and that they actually landed Air Force One without him in it. And he said he had to meet with the poor volunteers who volunteered to land Air Force One, an empty Air Force One, so that if anybody was going to get shot down, it would be them. He said, "That's what a terrible thing, but that's their job, and they said that they were going to do it." And he landed on a separate dummy plane because of these threats. So there were some kind of chilling James Bond moments. In fact, he even said in 1998.
Bin Laden is a kind of James Bond villain or something?
He said that Bin Laden was kind of like, believe it or not, he said he's like the villains in the James Bond movie. He has no direct connection with states, but he's kind of an amorphous international presence with a lot of money and terrorist design. So he said he's like Smersh. And this is before I'd even heard of Osama bin Laden.
Well, there's also a moment where Clinton says to you, understandable fears where bin Laden was concerned, and many have faulted him for not taking more action on that score. But he also says at one point, because he's trying to negotiate through peace in the Middle East and peace in Northern Ireland, he says, the Jews or the Irish are going to be the death of me. I mean, he did have that sense of humor and that kind of boyish Arkansas charm, and that comes across here as well. I mean, you really get to measure the man in your book, and a man that you have obviously had a long-standing affection for. And did that interfere with kind of your hat as a historian, or to what extent did it? In fact, I was kind of amused when I read Bill Clinton going out wanting to either name Mario Cuomo or Bruce Babbitt to the Supreme Court and saying, I can't find an honest man, like he's Diogenes. But then you think, is Bill Clinton an honest man? You know, there you have it in kind of some. Did you find, though, that kind of conflict as far as your historian had and your friendship with Bill Clinton?
Certainly. I mean, that's one of the reasons I recommended that he not try to have an in-house historian like Arthur Schlesinger. I said that wouldn't be taken seriously in this day and age, that even Arthur Schlesinger was to some degree marginalized as a historian and more as a pundit and apologist afterward, and that it would be much worse now. I don't consider this book a historical accounting. I think it's too soon to have some sort of analysis of Clinton. It's a gathering of the primary record. It's a gathering of raw material for future people to evaluate. That was our that
aren't
was
your
our
recordings
discipline.
Going to University of Virginia? Aren't they?
University of North Carolina.
Oh, University of North Carolina. Yeah.
Yeah. For other people to those are my dictations of all of these meetings and my impressions of what happened. And I do have judgments in here because I'm constantly second guessing what am I supposed to say here? This is a secret project. There's no precedent for it. There's no peer review. I can't talk to any historians about what questions to ask. And what's my role? I know the primary thing is that I want all the raw material and honest sounding stories on the record for people to evaluate in the future. But what do I do if he asks me for advice or if he starts baiting me? Because he likes interaction.
He did ask you for advice on a number of
occasions. And he should I fire the CIA director? Well, if I had said, Mr. President, I'm only here to ask questions, I think that it would have diminished our rapport and that he would have lost interest in the process, possibly. I mean, after all he had to do to stop this was to quit summoning me down to the White House. Once a month or something, I'd get at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, can you come down tonight? And I would gather up my recorders and drive down from Baltimore and get cleared into the residence and upstairs and never knew what I was going to find.
And what was your advice on firing CIA director?
Well, my advice was, yes, you should fire the CIA director. And I'm sure the CIA director won't appreciate that.
Well, you learn all kinds of little tidbits in Taylor Branch's new book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. You learn that President Clinton, like President Bush, loved high noon. You also learn why Chelsea decided to go to Stanford. There's a local angle. You want to talk about that for a moment?
Well, Chelsea, of course, grows up in the course of this over the course of this book. Most of our sessions were just the two of us, but because we were in the family quarters, Chelsea would wander in and out sometimes. She started off in high school.
You're helping with the paper on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein while he's talking about Bosnia, I mean.
Yes, and actually that was on the night of the Oklahoma City bombing. So we're sitting there trying to figure out whether this was terrorism from abroad and what kind of evil this was that would kill babies in the Oklahoma City federal building. And Chelsea comes in saying that she needs help on this essay about Dr. Frankenstein's evil, his evil qualities. So, yes, there were some surreal times. But later on, as she grew up, the president said he thought Harvard made a mistake in trying to recruit her by promising that she would that they would arrange events for her as the first child, and that they misread her because that turned her off, and that she liked Stanford, where they offered her instead the opportunity to be far away and pretty much on her own and treat her just like any other student.
We're coming up on a break, and I want to give you a phone number, those of you who would like to join us with questions or comments for our guest, Taylor Branch. In fact, feel free to do that now. Lines are open to you. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour, Taylor Branch, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. He's also written a trilogy on Martin Luther King Jr., the first installment of which won the Pulitzer Prize for History. And he'll be speaking tonight at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7:30 p.m. If you'd like to speak with him, grab a phone line, It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by email, and our email address is forum@kqed.org. And as many of you recall, Bill Clinton published an autobiography called My Life, and Taylor Branch was sort of like a little bit of, remember Michael Anthony, you know, Bill Clinton turns over a check for $50,000 to Taylor Branch. Like I said, we used to call it found money for helping him with My Life. By doing these conversations that you did that culminated in this book, but you urged him to actually delay the publication of My Life. You didn't think that really it should have come out when it did, and it didn't cover enough.
That was in the last chapter. Yes, that's covered in the last chapter, and it was, again, almost surreal because he asked me up to Chappaqua to read the manuscript for My Life. I thought it was finished. This is in 2004. I stayed up all night reading 700 pages, and when it ended, he hadn't even gone to the White House yet. So the next morning, I said, this is wonderful. I retract some of my previous advice that you not do a full-fledged autobiography. We had lots of conversations about that. But where's the rest of it? And he says, well, I'm working on it. I was working on it this morning, and I was flabbergasted. I said, Mr. President, this is February 27th, 2004. They've announced your book for publication on Father's Day in the middle of June, just a couple of months away. You cannot possibly cover your entire presidency in the next 6 weeks. This is irresponsible. It's insane. It wastes the tapes and your capacity to write great presidential memoirs, and you should postpone it. And he said he couldn't. He was going to get sued. And anyway, it's not the first time, but it was one of our most raucous disagreements. He finally ended saying, Taylor, will you say all that to Hillary? See if you can persuade her. So I had to repeat all of my arguments that this was not the right thing to do. But then just a few months later, I went down to Washington. He asked me to come down to Washington, and there was My Life. He had written it in an astonishing feat of stamina. I don't know how he did it, but he just wrote the whole in all-nighters. Wrote the book in a matter of a few weeks. And I had told him I thought it squandered the potential in our tapes, that we'd put all that effort in it. And he said, but that was for historians. That's for other people. Maybe other people can do that. When I went down there and he very sweetly signed a copy of My Life to me, he said, I know you didn't think I should do it this way, but I did. And I've got something for you here. Everybody, these tapes were indispensable for me to be able to do this thing as fast as I did. So, and he said, if you don't take this, you're going to hurt my feelings. And he gave me a check for $50,000 and said, you did 8 years of these tapes for nothing, and you did it as a public service, and you've never had a pot to piss in. Can I say that on the radio?
It's FCC.
And you still don't. And you've been working on Martin Luther King all these years, and sometimes I wish I had, but I want you to share in this. I'm giving bonuses to everybody who was involved in the book. And he handed this check to me and walked out, and I was kind of stunned.
Speaking about words you can't say, and I can't say this one, but it's interesting to learn that Hillary, who always some said was kind of a sailor in terms of her use of profanity, or called Gebhardt a few names, which we can't say on the air here. I get all these kind of tidbits from your book. Just one quick question, and I want to go to callers, about talking about Clinton's cerebrality and his ability to multitask. I remember a conversation I had with the great Mexican novelist Carlos Fuentes, and he said he was in a dinner with Clinton and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and he said that Clinton was what he would characterize as, and he didn't use this word at all freely, an intellectual. That, you know, he had read all, clearly had read all of Faulkner and was very conversant with Faulkner's works, but also was able to speak on a high philosophical plane, that this was something he felt guarded about, especially as an Arkansas politician, and kept kind of covert or maybe under wraps. I mean, you agree with that sense of his being really even a towering type of intellect?
I don't know about towering, but certainly an intellectual. He was constantly surprising me about the reading that he was doing, because we were having our sessions at midnight, and he said he was an insomniac and must have stayed up and read after that. But speaking of Garcia Marquez, I mean, he frequently talked about him, that they were friends, that Garcia Marquez had sent him a private manuscript about Colombia and the relationship between the government and the drug cartels and the courage that it took to be a Colombian politician. He said it was just searing, and it made him ashamed that most Americans just assume that the Colombians don't care about integrity in government because Americans have no idea what something like that is like, that he talked to Gabriel Garcia Marquez about Fidel Castro, and because they were friends, and that Castro, Marquez told him that Castro felt that he had made a terrible mistake shooting down those planes over Cuba at a time when Clinton was making overtures to relax the embargo, which he said even the Pope says that the embargo against Cuba is stupid, and that we should get rid of it, but he couldn't do it, and he would talk to Garcia Marquez about it. He said that Gabriel Garcia Marquez sent Chelsea an inscribed copy of all of his works because one summer at Martha's Vineyard, he was so impressed that a 14-year-old had read 100 Years of Solitude and the way Chelsea was talking with him about it. So, yes, I think throughout the whole family, there were constant nuggets of an intellectual quality that I think would surprise people. He would. Did you see Taylor? Why haven't you read the new biography of Benjamin Franklin, the one before Walter Isaacson's? I forget what it was by the professor down at Texas A&M. He was always reading things like this, and Hillary was by far the fiercest opponent of impeachment, even an impeachment that grew out of a humiliation for her. President Clinton would sometimes say, this is politics. If they want to throw me, this is during the trial. We had sessions during the trial. If they want to throw me out of office, they can do it. And Hillary, who happened to be there, said, no, Bill, that's wrong. Impeachment is a very special procedure in our form of government for abuses of presidential power. If they convict you on this, it will destabilize our country for decades. And she was much fiercer on that than
he was.
She was
more fierce toward the right-wing conspiracy as well.
Yes.
I'll just tease people about your book because there's some fascinating material about Clinton and Gore after Gore lost. Let me go to your calls, though, and we'll go to Nicasio first. Mike, good morning.
Hi, Mike. As usual, great show. My question is sort of a sad one because you were so close to him in a certain way. Throughout his presidency, it seemed that his brilliance, his tremendous wide range also contributed to having overflowing meetings with too many opinions and also a lack of span of concentration to run the country. Did you get that impression at all?
Well, that's a good question. There were times when he himself said that maybe he wasn't a good enough actor, that he needed to be more like Reagan, who would ride in and announce a decision and then ride out and intimidate the press. He said he liked the process. He said that's what government is. It's give and take, and that the result, for example, of the great budget crisis meetings that were so chaotic in 1993 was setting the country on a course to eliminate the deficit. He said, judging by the results, we're doing politics the right way. We have unemployment at 4.2% and 20 million new jobs and peace negotiations all around the world. But if you the public culture focuses on the chaotic media in part to make it more entertaining. So he did say that at times he possibly should conceal some of that more to affect a more authoritative pose, and that that might change the public culture. So he recognized that, and I kept saying, if you judge by the results, you get a different picture.
And, Mike, we thank you for your call. I want to get as many on as we can. We go to Betsy next. Welcome, Betsy.
Good morning. I'm feeling a little bit like this is on the edge of voyeurism, and I'm wondering if you talked to President Clinton ahead of time and got permission to put this book out, or if you feel like in some ways you violated his trust by putting it out.
The book was his idea.
It was his idea.
Okay. Somewhere in the second term, about the time that he started entrusting me with where he was hiding his tapes, I gave him advice on what he should do with the tapes and that he should keep them rather than me, which was one option. Toward the end, he was getting called away, and he was, his trust that we were keeping it secret was high enough. He showed me that he was hiding the tapes in his sock drawer, put them away so that I could put them away and make sure that they were all intact. Somewhere in that period, he said, you know, after I do my memoirs and have the first crack at these tapes, you might want to think about doing a memoir about what it's like to gather them. Because nobody's ever done anything like this with a sitting president. And we did discuss that from then on. I didn't show him the book until it was done and going off to the printer, but I was happy that that he thought it was a worthwhile thing to give people a peek into the White House a little bit through my point of view of what it was like.
He had some concern over some of the details, didn't he?
Well, when I took him the book, he said, this is more personal about the family than he would like. He was uncomfortable about it, and I don't blame him. I'd be uncomfortable if he wrote a book about me and my family, too.
Well, you write about your own family in the book as well, though, actually.
I do write about my own family.
In fact, your wife was wrote for Hillary Clinton, wrote speeches.
Just for in the last couple of years. Yes, that led to one amazing night when he wanted to keep talking and invited me to spend the night. And I said, well, my wife is over still working late. It's after midnight. Can she stay over, too, rather than have us both drive to Baltimore and come back? And he wound up, there were no pillows on the beds in the Queen bedroom or the Lincoln bedroom, and the president wound up wandering all over the White House trying to find us pillows and finally gave us his. Hillary was out of town. Totally stunned my wife because we're walking around. The president of the United States is looking for a pillow. All the staff has gone home. And when he found one, he walked us all the way back down with us all the while begging him, you know, we can do it, and detoured into his office and walked around touching all of his books. And when he finally got us into the bedroom and left, my wife, Christy, turned to me and says, what was that? And I said, well, that was very nice. Yes, it was amazing that he searched around for a pillow. And she said, no, I don't mean that. The compulsive walking around, touching his books and taking them out, putting them back
in. It's
like obsessive
compulsive disorder. Yeah.
And I realized that I was so used to that, I said, he does that all the time.
We'll go to more of your calls. We'll go next to Morristown, New Jersey. Bob, you're on. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? This is admittedly a very odd question, but I met Bill Clinton twice, once when he was governor and getting ready to run for the presidency, and secondly, after he had been elected to his first term. First time I met him, I'm 6 foot tall. I could look him in the eye. The second time, he was a couple inches taller than I was. At least that was my perception. Do you know if he ever used lifts? I told you, it's been bothering me for you know, all those years. You know, he got elected, what, 92? I met him in 93. It's been bothering me.
And you haven't been able to have a sleep full night since then?
I have not had a full night's sleep since.
Well, that is an eccentric question, but lots of times when I would talk with him, he'd be barefooted, and I'm about 6 feet tall, and he's a couple of inches taller than I am, barefooted. So I think I don't think that he uses lifts.
I think you got an answer at long last, Bob. Thank you. Here's Max from Berkeley who wants an answer to his question. He says, "Thank you for an informative program. I'm enjoying it. Although I have not read the book, I look forward to doing so shortly. Would you please ask Mr. Branch if former President Clinton had anything to say about Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a man he returned to power and who subsequently double-crossed him? Has former President Clinton revealed his insights into the Haitian predicament, a situation he is actively involved in these days?" And certainly there's a lot about that in your book.
There's a lot about Haiti in the book. I have to say it's a great sadness to me that some of the reviews have said there's too much about Haiti, and a lot of people have said that they don't care about Haiti. He did.
And does. As
and still
it,
does. And sent American troops to restore Haiti. One of our roughest sessions was that we had a session the night before his speech to the country explaining why he was going to send troops in 1994 to restore Aristide to power. And he said he was just moaning. He said, I have 8% public support. And my best friends in politics, Senator Dale Bumpers of Arkansas, have told me I will be impeached if there are any casualties, that nobody cares about this. At one point, he said that he had racism working for his policy when the Haitians were washing up on the shores, but he stopped that from happening. Now he says he had racism working against him because nobody cared about Haiti because it was black. He said, this is the poorest country in our hemisphere that's had tyranny for two centuries, and they've had an election in which people were slaughtered in the street by thugs to keep despotism in power. He had designed this this intervention to give Haiti a chance. That's all he was going to do. There were zero casualties. And he said, I'm going to do it anyway. But there was an undercurrent since I knew Aristide and had taken messages back and forth. This is the only instance in the book where I'm actually undertaking tasks for him, which, again, made me nervous. There was an undertone that this was kind of my fault, that I had maneuvered him in. He never would say that, and I knew he didn't do that. This was what he wanted to do, but he was feeling so politically exposed that this was a rant about doing it. And it always bugged me. What happened in Haiti is another story. His relationship with Aristide is a private story. It's all in the book. But the part that bothered me is that the mantra could continue in the country that this was somebody who never did anything out of conviction and that was a finger-in-the-wind politician captive to Dick Morris and other idiots that that Clinton hardly ever mentioned.
That reputation lasted for years with Clinton, and particularly when he shifted gears on welfare before he was elected a second time. And I know there was an article that you wrote, I believe, in Esquire that said that tried to sort of dispute the idea that he was completely run by Dick Morris in the polls and, you know, dictated to by that. And yet that reputation sustained throughout his campaign.
Yes, but see, that's a there are two ways to look at that. That's either a perversity in the culture flying into the face of the facts, or there's something to it. Unfortunately, of course, I was so constrained that I couldn't argue, say he doesn't ever talk about Dick Morris because I couldn't reveal the fact that I was having any of these sessions. So it was a frustration to me, and I would retreat basically back into my Martin Luther King work and keep all of the Clinton work private. But there were a lot of things that he did out of conviction. For example, all the gun bills, the Brady bill, the assault weapons ban, even President Obama says, I'm not going near the NRA. It's suicide. Clinton did it for 8 years. And the tobacco industry and a number of things that he took on the basis of conviction, including welfare.
Why not Rwanda? I mean, I think that's one of – it was certainly Madeleine Albright said on this program it was her great regret. I think it was one of his, maybe also Bosnia, that he didn't go in as quickly as he could have or might have, but particularly Rwanda. I mean, especially somebody as sensitive to racism as he was.
There's a lot about both of those. There's no simple answer, certainly on Bosnia. Bosnia, it was trying to assemble an international coalition where he thought that there was a lot of subterfuge by the European nations who thought that Bosnia that there should be no Muslim nation in the heart of Europe. So that's a much more complicated. It reminded me of the internecine private politics about Jews, the treatment of Jews in World War II.
With FDR, yeah.
With FDR and that sort of thing. And so there was a lot about that. Now, Rwanda, he did say, like Madeleine Albright, that it was a great regret. There are lots of passages in the book where he describes meeting Rwandans and even talking to Kosovars about trying to make peace and what had happened in Rwanda. But in the real time in our sessions, he said that he thought it was impractical that Rwanda happened so rapidly that 750,000 people were killed within 3 months, that unless you have lightning force military intervention for which there would have been very little public support, that as a practical matter, you can say we should have acted more rapidly, but this is not something like Darfur that stretched out over a long period. It happened pretty quickly, and it's not likely that we could have intervened effectively even if we'd wanted to. He also said it was not on CNN, and the fact that what was happening in Rwanda was not on CNN had a pretty big political effect. It was too remote.
I remember interviewing Ambassador Dennis Ross, who blamed the inability to come to peace in the Middle East, largely on Arafat, said, you know, he didn't pull the trigger, and when it came time, really down to it and everything. But Clinton was very critical of just about everybody involved, wasn't he?
Well, I think
including Ehud Barak.
Well, that's a very subtle thing at the end, and I would leave that to Middle East experts. Clinton basically supported what Dennis Ross said about Arafat turning down the deal. But then right as Clinton is leaving, he presented another deal on December 23rd, 2000, to both Arafat and Barak in the White House. And the subtle implication from what he's saying is that he presented his own terms, skewed a little bit against Israel to give Arafat a more favorable deal in the hopes that Barak would turn it down and say, you've gone too far. Because Clinton felt that Arafat had to go first and be able to say, I accept a deal that is too tough for Barak. He said if that had happened.
It's a negotiation ploy, basically.
Yes, but instead, Barak said yes. He surprised everybody. He went farther than an Israeli prime minister would ever be expected to go for a chance to run in the next elections on a peace deal, even if it was one quite favorable to the Palestinians. And Clinton said once Barak said yes, it was harder for Arafat to say no because the stateless person, the exile psychology makes it hard for him to accept a deal that Barak had already accepted. So the timing and the subtleties at the end are very complex.
We're talking again with Taylor Branch, whose new book is The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. If you'd like to become part of this program and the time remaining, it's toll-free. You can join us at 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. Bill from San Jose joins us. Morning, Bill.
Hi. First of all, I'm a big fan of your books. Secondly, I just wanted to ask, Bill Clinton seemed to surround himself with a number of youth advocates, including Marion Wright Edelman and, of course, his own wife. And yet, at the same time, Clinton seemed to be the most viciously anti-youth president we've ever had, with V-chips, curfew laws, school uniforms, abstinence education, etc. Did you ever get a sense about why this contradiction existed, or did he ever express any remorse about the way he was treating young people?
No, I think that it would be news to him that he's anti-youth. I think he thought in education and most of his policies, including trying to end the deficit, were pro-youth in the sense that the deficit is a gigantic public mortgage hanging over unborn children. That he thinks the American public is inattentive and selfish when it comes to young people. So I don't think he would accept your premise, even on welfare. He said the people that that hate welfare the most are the people who are on it, and that only people who patronize welfare recipients enjoyed or supported the system as it was.
Bill, we thank you, and we'll move along to Melissa. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Hi. This is Melissa, and I just have a quick question about what happened in Kosovo. And I completely adore Clinton, but the one thing I always had a question about was, did he pull a wag-the-dog kind of measure with what was going on here with his impeachment and what he did there?
Well, we had a number of sessions on Kosovo, which was very complex and was an agonizing tightrope, if on no other dimension, on the dimension that they were trying to accomplish militarily by air power alone, what every military expert in the world said was impossible, that you couldn't compel Milosevic to withdraw his Serb troops from Kosovo by military power alone, by air power. And that was the only thing that Clinton could get the NATO and the European Union to agree on. So he did it at the last moment. Otherwise, Milosevic was going to slaughter every last Albanian Kosovar in the region. Miraculously, even military experts say this is the first instance where air power alone worked without any casualties. And to do something like that on the timetable that he did had nothing to do with impeachment. Impeachment pretty much came in on its own timetable, and the Republicans impeached him after losing seats in the 1998 election, running on impeachment. So, again, I think this is something that came in the public culture, that the Republicans attacked him and said that he did Kosovo for political reasons, but it was a very effective way to deflect attention from the fact that, politically speaking, it was a pretty awesome success.
Well, we learned from your book that Milosevic had a theory of the JFK assassination, which is fascinating.
Yes.
And also that Clinton once said to you bluntly, talking about politics, Democrats sell access, Republicans control. Sell control. What an interesting dichotomy that is. I mean, Clinton was politically astute, although some of these things, like Barbara Mikulski as a running mate for Gore and that he had projected were way off base. But let me try to get a final caller in here, and that's you, Fiona. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm asking, did President Bill Clinton ever watch News Times during the genocide of Rwanda? And if so, did he show any remorse or sadness?
And you're from Rwanda, Fiona?
Yes,
is that
yes
right?
I am.
Yes. Do you know if he saw any of the slaughtering and what kind of reaction he had to
that? All I know is that he remarked that it was not on CNN, that what was going on was not on CNN the way the O.J. Simpson trial was, which was the same year, or the O.J. Simpson episode later. I wasn't there usually during the news. I was there much later at night. And we didn't watch television, so I couldn't really say exactly what he did.
He was watching CNN for the most part, though.
He did watch CNN.
Because Obama's not watching Fox, I believe, now. We've made,
yes,
we've gotten that clear.
We're told that.
Yeah. Taylor Branch with us this hour, and again, you can meet him tonight. He'll be at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7:30. His book is The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. So good to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you that we're going to be talking in the next hour about health IT, that is information technology and its uses in terms of healthcare, especially as we possibly move toward major reform in healthcare. We're way behind in terms of our electronic moving from paper to electronics. We'll find out all about that in the hour ahead. I hope you'll join us for that. I want to remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.